appellant versus Stephen Schwartz, M.D., appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Lowes, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Lonnie Braun. Justices Sabres and Konenkamp have disqualified themselves also on this case, and the court has once again appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur to sit for Justice Sabres and the Honorable Douglas Hoffman to sit for Justice Konenkamp. One reminder on your way out the door after the end of this argument, if you have any interest after listening to these arguments and our publications, please feel free to help yourselves. With that, Mr. Lowes, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Lowes, and I'm proud to be here at my alma mater representing Diane Rousseau in this medical malpractice case. I'd like to begin with a very brief excerpt from the trial transcript that I think will help the court understand the very important issues involved. I'm citing to Volume 2, page 183, and this is Dr. Schwartz's direct examination by Mr. Braun. It begins, "Could you state your full name for the record, please?" Answer, "Stephen Schwartz." "Your occupation, sir?" Answer, "Neurosurgeon." Question, "You were involved in the care and treatment of Ms. Rousseau?" Answer, "Yes, I was." Question, "And you're here to testify about your care of Ms. Rousseau?" Answer, "Yes, I am." With those few words, an impression was created with this jury that Dr. Schwartz bore the credibility and the status and the skill and knowledge of a neurosurgeon reasonably trained in his profession. Not just that they're testifying was a doctor, but in fact a neurosurgeon, literally a brain surgeon. And I think that level of credibility creates for the jury the impression that what they are about to hear is very technical, very specialized, and given the circumstances, true and correct information. What the jury was not allowed to hear, however, was that within a year of his care and treatment of my client, a complaint was made with the state medical board, and that within a year after that, Dr. Schwartz agreed that his license needed to be placed on probation on the basis of malpractice, that it was a public order of probation, that he waived all rights that he had to a hearing or the protections of any privileges that he might have, that his training was in remedial neurosurgery and neuroradiology, the precise subjects about which Dr. Schwartz then testified, as we referenced in our brief, for over 100 single-spaced lines. The problem with the impression that was created by those few words, that I am a neurosurgeon and I am here to testify about my care of the plaintiff, is that it was a false impression. And my client was denied a fair trial by not being able to disabuse the jury.
Well, what should he have said? He was answering questions from opposing counsel. He's under oath.
Mr. Chief Justice, he was answering questions from his own counsel.
All right.
Indeed,
okay.
Under oath.
So what should he have said then?
Well, I think it's maybe more fundamental than that, that he had a choice whether to testify at all. He had a retained expert, a Dr. Bailey, that he brought in to testify about the care and treatment that he provided to Ms. Rousseau. He also had a choice about whether he was going to enter into a stipulation and an order placing his medical license on probation, that at the time he provided testimony in Ms. Rousseau's case was still in effect. He was not, at the day that he testified to our jury, was not allowed to practice medicine as a private practitioner. He had to be part of a group. It was part of the probationary order that for 5 years he could not practice on his own. So I'm not criticizing the fact that he was put on the stand and was asked what his profession is, but I think it does, Mr. Chief Justice, go to the argument that the court created some kind of balance because he wasn't able to say, I went to this medical school and I was trained at this facility for 5 years. I think the idea that you're a neurosurgeon says it all. It's not like he was testifying, I'm a phlebotomist, where half the jury might say, I wouldn't have any idea what that was. I think most people would understand a brain surgeon is a brain surgeon. And so the issues that we brought before the court are essentially one issue, that my client was denied the opportunity for a fair trial because we could not talk about or reference or question Dr. Schwartz or his other experts about this order of probation. And we believe there was two reasons it should have come in. First of all, the pattern jury instruction, which reflects the law of this state, mandates that Dr. Schwartz comply with two duties to patients like my client: to have the skill and knowledge of a reasonably trained neurosurgeon. That is a duty separate and apart from the duty to use that care and skill and to be diligent in his services provided to the patient.
But I got to stop you right there, because when you say it's separate and apart, that doesn't mean that you get a verdict just because you didn't possess the standard of care. The jury has to also find that you didn't exercise or use it.
I would respectfully disagree.
Well, let me put it this way. Maybe you've got a physician who's operating out on the outer edge of his area of practice, and maybe the physician isn't totally competent to provide the service that he or she does. But they go ahead and do it in a totally acceptable manner that meets the standard of care. There's no liability under those circumstances.
I guess the issue that...
I'm asking as a question. There wouldn't be liability.
It would depend, and it would depend on this. And first, let's start with the idea that the policy as set forth in that jury instruction in the law is not an unreasonable or particularly high standard. It makes sense that physicians would have the requisite skill and knowledge to treat patients. And I think the idea that if you lack that in the extraordinary case, which was referenced in the last argument, it's extraordinary that there's even an issue about whether a physician possesses the requisite skill and knowledge. But in that extraordinary case where you can prove that, I don't believe that the policy of this state should be that that physician who went about and practiced medicine without the requisite skill and knowledge gets passed because he simply got lucky or got it right.
So your point is, this is that kind of an extraordinary case.
Oh, it certainly is extraordinary in my experience, and I would defer to the preceding counsel who have much more experience than I when they say you typically don't have this issue in a medical malpractice case, whether or not the initial duty was satisfied. And I think, Chief Justice Gilbertson, you raised the specter in the first argument. Well, what is it? Is it automatically or negligence per se if you breach this first duty? And I think as a matter of interpreting our law and the instructions, that it is negligence. The instruction says if you breach the duty to have the requisite skill and knowledge, that is negligence. Now, what level of causation necessarily follows? I would submit to the court that if the patient is then harmed by a physician who has been proven to not have the skill and knowledge to treat that patient, if the medical treatment causes harm, regardless of whether it complied with the standard of care, whether you got lucky or not, I think liability follows. And that was, I'll use the example of this case. Ms. Mousseau, after her second surgery with Dr. Schwartz, testified to neurologic deficits, including one of her legs that just absolutely had no strength at all. And at trial, the defense on that issue was, you weren't hurt. You weren't hurt at all. And if you were hurt, you were hurt not by my client's procedure, but by a condition called diabetic neuropathy. And so our case bears out the scenario of what would happen in the very rare case that I think fits this fact: a physician does not have the requisite skill, should not be treating patients. I shouldn't then have to, on that separate duty, go and prove that he also breached the standard of care. All I need to prove is that treatment that should have never been rendered harmed the patient. It's a fair issue on causation because it was raised in this case. Were you harmed at all? Were you harmed by the surgery? But if I could prove that he didn't have the skill and knowledge, it follows that harm from that treatment should result in liability. And I think juries are perfectly competent to address those types of issues.
But isn't that an academic argument? Because you're claiming that the doctor breached both aspects of the standard of care, aren't you?
Correct. In this case, we allege that he didn't have the skill and knowledge, but we were completely undercut, Judge, completely undercut by the inability to offer any evidence about his skill or knowledge. Other than the fact that he testified that I'm a neurosurgeon, that was it. Now,
so is the more precise issue in this particular case whether, had you been able to delve more deeply into the issue of his possessing of skill and knowledge, that would have further affected the analysis of whether he exercised that same skill and knowledge in this particular case?
I agree completely.
All right. I'm just trying to understand your argument on that point.
I agree completely that, and I think this court has made reference to that in the Martin Moss case, when this court talked about why it was fair game to talk about a doctor not having a medical license. The court said that that bears on the physician's credibility, and it also bore, in that case, on his opinions about standard of care. And so I think we're talking about the same thing. His credibility, that is, he's sitting there as a neurosurgeon on the witness stand, and the idea that we weren't allowed to question him about the order of probation that he agreed to certainly goes to that issue about his credibility on standard of care and other issues.
What did you propose that you would have asked him along that line? Did the judge know exactly what line of questioning you were going to pursue with that losing or agreeing to get additional training and so forth? How much were you going to delve into that? Did you talk about that and make an offer to the judge?
We did, Your Honor. We made an offer of proof. It was essentially two parts. And while we didn't articulate exactly how the back and forth would go, I don't think any lawyer would have to go into that kind of detail about how we cross-examine a witness. But we certainly talked about bringing out the idea that as he sits here today, his license was restricted and that he couldn't practice on his own, that within 2 years of providing surgical treatment to my client, his license was placed on probation as a public record for malpractice. And we also made an offer of proof, Your Honor, on the idea that the expert witness on our side should be able to speak to the order of probation in terms of what that means on this duty to possess the skill and knowledge of a neurosurgeon in good standing. In other words, if expert testimony was required about whether Dr. Schwartz had skill and knowledge, the expert retained on our side was going to use the order of probation to speak to that issue. So I think it was fairly well covered in the offer of proof. Certainly, it would have been very, very important evidence in this case. And
now, you could go to credibility, as you suggest, but in this case, no one's challenging that jury instruction?
No.
If for some reason we decide that that first part of that jury instruction isn't acceptable, then does your argument go away?
Not necessarily, because the order was certainly important on the issue of Dr. Schwartz's testimony, both as a fact witness and as an expert witness, as we allege in our brief. So, no, I don't believe so. I think it would be, I'm not sure the circumstances that this court would deem that it's the law in South Dakota that a physician wouldn't have to have baseline skill and knowledge when they treat patients. But related to that point, I would refer the court to its very recent and not so recent cases regarding the importance of expert testimony in medical malpractice cases. From the very first days of Maglehut versus Kevorek, this court articulated what lawyers then and now know is that medical malpractice trials are battles of the experts. And I believe in the Kaiser case, this court actually used the phrase, it was a battle of the experts. And how critically important technical testimony is in medical malpractice cases. I'd refer you to the Kaiser case, where an opinion of an expert witness was not disclosed until trial. And this court found that so central to the case that allowing it to come in, even under the abuse of discretion standard, allowing that opinion to come in was reversible error. In the more recent case, the 2007 case, Papke versus Harvard, I believe that's the case where the expert opinions were previously disclosed, but the expert witness for the defense showed up with three pathological slides that hadn't been disclosed, two of which were demonstrative, only one of which was admitted substantively. And under the abuse of discretion standard, this court said, because he is an expert in a medical malpractice case, the prejudice to the plaintiff was plain. And I think the same thing applies here. You can go back to the Schrader v. Tarks, T-J-A-R-K-S case. Medical malpractice case where the plaintiffs were deprived of the ability to offer rebuttal experts. Medical malpractice case involving expert testimony, this court deemed that under the abuse of discretion standard reversible error. And so I don't think it's any secret to anybody that practices in this area, nor this court, how critically important the technical testimony is in these cases. And this case was no different. An absolute battle of the experts from the beginning of the opening statement, where Mr. Braun said, please the court, counsel, clerks, Ms. Musso, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we're going to spend the rest of the week talking about two sad stories. The first sad story involves Dr. Tuber and Dr. Schwartz. Dr. Tuber is going to come and testify that Dr. Schwartz's care deviated from the standard of care. As far as I know, he is the only one in this case to so testify. He also continued right to the closing argument. The very first words, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here because we've got a competitor who doesn't like Dr. Schwartz and provided you with a non-objective evaluation of the medical care that was provided to Ms. Musso. He described Dr. Tuber as a disliked competitor that you're in a lawsuit with. I mean, these are the first things that the jury is hearing in opening and closing and was part of the examination at trial. So there's no question. And that's fair game. I mean, that's what these cases are about. But the battle of the experts being the standard, it's up to the courts to make sure that it's a fair fight. Mr. Braun should have been able to indicate that Dr. Tuber was maybe a less than credible witness. Well, we sure should have been able to articulate that Dr. Schwartz was maybe a less than credible doctor. And that's the essence of our argument. That it was completely one-sided. The issue is so central to the case, particularly a medical malpractice case. So on the issue that there's a duty, it's a simple analysis. It's the relevance sort of trilogy of, is it relevant evidence? Does it tend to make a question of fact that is in dispute more or less probable? We learned that the first day here at the law school in evidence class. More or less probable. Well, Dr. Schwartz, according to the jury instructions, not objected to by Mr. Braun, has a duty to have the skill and knowledge. What could be more relevant, that whether he possessed skill and knowledge, than the fact that 2 years after providing surgical treatment to my client, his license was on probation for malpractice.
It seemed to me, though, that the trial judge zeroed in more on that if he gave an opinion, it would come in,
right,
rather than relevancy. Isn't that?
I think so. And it came up in the first argument about why was it that this was excluded, and I think it was part of the...
Well, he said he'd let it in if Schwartz would...
If Dr. Schwartz...
Start giving an opinion on, I assume, standard of care.
If Dr. Schwartz used the language, my care and treatment complied with the standard of care, that was the trial court's rationale, which I would echo Mr. Braun in his sentiments that Judge Fuller obviously thought about this, but on that particular point, he is just not correct. Because if you were testifying...
Did the doctor give his opinion on anything? Should it have come in just because
he did not say the words? He did not say the words, I did not breach the standard of care. On the fiction, Your Honor, that he was just a fact witness. But let's look at that. If the facts are, the facts you're testifying to are detailed analysis of the anatomy, the reading of X-ray and MRI films, the impression that these readings created upon you, the process of your diagnosing the patient and your medical decision-making, a detailed discussion of two spine surgeries. I mean, if those are the facts that you're testifying to, I'm sorry, you're an expert. Whether you use the words, I didn't breach the standard of care or not. So, yeah, I know what the rationale was. I just disagree with it under the facts and circumstances of this case. We would ask that this court reverse and allow Ms. Michaud a fair trial with the admission of the requested information.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Brown, you have 20 minutes, sir.
It's been a long time since I've seen you. May it please the court.
Can I start by asking you, when you read the testimony, and a lot of it was quoted in the briefs and reading the entire testimony of the doctor, he certainly gave his opinion on why he decided to do this and why he decided to do that. Why shouldn't this information come in about his license and malpractice?
Okay. And, of course, Justice Meyer Henry, you're proceeding from the assumption that if he provided anything that appeared to be expert testimony, then anything and everything is fair game.
Well, I thought that's what Judge Fuller ruled.
Well, I mean, that's what Judge Fuller ruled. That certainly is not our position. And the issue that we had taken, we talked about in the last argument, was that Dr. Schwartz, like the defendant in Martin Moss, should have been able to explain who he was and what he did.
I know, but even beyond that, though, as he gets into explaining why he did certain things and why he didn't tell her this or why he told her that and why he would only do the one surgery and not the whole thing, I mean, he gives opinion. It seems to me he's given his opinion all the way through, or periods, parts of his testimony.
Okay. And what he's doing, you know, what he is doing, and if you review the transcript, you'll see that Judge Fuller makes a clear statement that's probably accurate. He said this is no different than a plumber describing what tool he picked up, what he did, what he saw, and whatever. But he never gets into, you know, is this standard of care? So, I mean, that's...
So you think it's limited to just standard of care, and as long as he didn't give an opinion about standard of care, it didn't become fair game?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. I think this court's opinion in Boomsma, again, that we talked about more extensively in the last argument, but that was a circumstance where somebody had stipulated with a board. They'd actually given up their license to practice. We're not going to fuss with this. Obviously, there had been allegations made. Obviously, there were documents. This court held that it was perfectly permissible to find that was unfairly prejudicial and that it's a stipulation that should not be used as evidence. I think we go farther, Justice Meyer Henry, in this case, and we look at what is it that they want to introduce. I mean, he started his argument with, we want to put in the facts of that stipulation. And, of course, in Martin Moss, this court looked carefully at the statute that creates the privilege for peer review information.
But wasn't this public? Wasn't this more than a peer review? It was actually public.
The document was stipulated that it could be public. That still was a peer review process, and the statute still says that the testimony of a witness or documentary evidence of any kind on proceedings are not admissible in evidence in any action of any kind. In any court, excuse me. And that is the statute. This document could never have been admitted as long as this court stays with its rulings in Martin Moss that the statutes mean what they say. This is a very specialized class of evidence. The important question isn't whether they were allowed to discover what the agreement was.
The question is whether it was admissible in court, and by statute it never was.
But a stipulation is not evidence.
The stipulation is documentary. They wanted to use it as documentary evidence from the Board of Medical Examiners.
But it wasn't evidence in the proceeding before the Board of Medical Examiners. Isn't that what the statute's talking about?
I think it's talking about anything that comes out of those proceedings is to be dealt with there. It is not usable in another proceeding. As this court held, even though there were transcripts taken in Marcon's and testimony, that it was improper for that to even be disclosed. The statute is very specific and very precise. Mr. Lowe's then wanted to talk about, he said, I'm a doctor. And now it's there to do this. And I think that we have now, through two arguments, ripened this thing down to what both of these sets of counsel want. And that's that they want that this court to eliminate the cause element in these cases. We've now heard two arguments, and the only authority for a jury deciding whether a doctor has the appropriate care and skill is the pattern jury instruction that was borrowed from the Bodgy instructions years and years ago, the same as many of those of our pattern jury instructions were. Now we're in a circumstance where we need to look at it. Mr. Lowe's actually indicated to this court that if he can prove to a jury that Dr. Schwartz doesn't have the skill or care, that any harm that comes to the patient is compensable.
No, he said any harm that's legally caused or proximately caused. He said you still have the causal connection requirement that you do in all negligence cases. So even if the jury finds that he may have not possessed or used the standard of care, Mr. Lowe agrees he still had to prove that there was harm caused by that lack. And the jury was so instructed here.
And as I understood his argument, and you certainly understood it different than I did, it was that if he proves the first element and any harm results to his client because of care of my client, not deviation from the standard of care, any care, that then he's entitled to compensation. And then he switched to an example, and that was that Ms. Mousseau had other medical conditions, including a diabetic neuropathy, that explained the problems that she was having. And he was telling you that he felt that that would become compensable and eliminate the cause element from the standard of care. And I think it's important, again, to go back and look at that the Fierstead case and what this court said, because we got to the right spot there in Martinez, because the court has many times quoted the instruction. It's never approved it, as near as I can tell. And when it gets down to what is the issue to be decided, it says that the issue for the jury is whether the care met the standard. Mr. Lowe's is sitting here. He's telling you that the care in this case did not meet the standard. He says he put on an expert, and he did. He put on Dr. Tuber. And Dr. Tuber came loaded for bear, and he told the jury everything that he thought about Dr. Schwartz's care of Ms. Mousseau, and that is the appropriate evidence to decide the issues in this case. What he wants to do, though, is to shift off to the side and eliminate any 403 analysis, that just because this stipulation exists, that then we are going to talk about you're a bad person.
Well,
and of course that raises...
The judge could have done the balancing on 403 and still not allowed it in, correct?
Yes.
But you never got that far.
Well, the judge did many balancings. Justice Meyer Henry, obviously. Judge Fuller had about a full-time job with these things for quite some period of time, even though the record doesn't reflect it, the chief judge got tired of every judge having to hear the same issues, and all the cases ended up in Judge Fuller's hands. And nobody objected to that, so that's the way we went with it. But yes, Judge Fuller did many balancings. But the balancing in Martinez, where the circumstances are much more egregious than here, where we do have transcripts, we have criminal issues, we have allegations of crimes, And the only thing that was appropriately permitted was the fact that Dr. Engelman wasn't any licensed practice medicine anymore. That was the only thing. Why? Because the issue for the Martin Moss jury was, did he perform within the standard of care? Not, where did he go to medical school? That's not the jury issue. That's an issue for the regulatory agencies and not for the jury. In Fierstead, this court reached the perfect decision and the appropriate one in looking at the intern, because they were saying, much as Mr. DeLos did here, this intern was negligent. He lacked skill, lacked knowledge. He didn't have a license. And this court clearly held that before somebody can be held liable for professional negligence, that they have to breach the standard. And breaching what a reasonable neurosurgeon would do is what is an issue, not are we going to set this thing up, because its propensity, and as this court would be well aware, if this stipulation or any form of it came in, particularly if Dr. Tuber got to give his opinion, as Mr. Lowe suggested, of what he thinks the stipulation means, that we are going to have a document being touted as this proves that this doctor acted in conformity with this character trait. And, of course, that takes us right to 404B or 403, whichever one. But 404B, you cannot introduce other acts simply to show that in this circumstance, likely the doctor did something wrong.
You know, but does 404B even apply to competency? 404B applies to character.
Exactly.
Isn't competency different than character?
But what they want to do here, Justice Zinner, is to use, and they really don't talk much about 404B, but you end up there because what do they want to talk about? Other bad acts. And 404B is the specific evidence.
If and only if the evidence is introduced solely for character, what about competency?
And this is what I'm saying, Justice Zinner, is competency is not a jury issue. Court has never held that competency is a jury issue. I think that in a malpractice case, what this court has said, and what courts in general say, and we even provided some that got stuck with this difficult question that hasn't come up, that normally doesn't come up, is that the question is, you have to establish what a reasonable neurosurgeon would do under the circumstances, and then you have to show where he deviated from the standard of care. The jury doesn't get into, did you have the right number of credits? Did you come out and pass your flex exam? Did you attend the required number of days during your residency? Those things are all done elsewhere. The jury's decision is what would a reasonable neurosurgeon do under the circumstances, and what is the result? And if he didn't do what a reasonable neurosurgeon would do, then he's liable.
How do you address the argument that's been raised in both these cases that this is a different or an extraordinary case because this case actually involves a question of the physician's competency?
Yes. And I think that issue has been created. I mean, it's an extraordinary case in that which of us in this room with, you know, hundreds of years of experience that I know that you and us have looked at where a doctor has targeted another doctor to create complaints and problems and issues and whatever. I mean, it is an extraordinary case, but I think that in the circumstances of their side of the issue, they want to talk about that as competence. If these cases are as clear, if this conduct is as egregious as they say it is, Justice Zinner, they should be able to put on their expert to show, here's what neurosurgeons do, here's what the literature shows, here's the practice and procedure, and I shouldn't be able to destroy that evidence with reasonable cross-examination, and they should win. But not on the fact of, look here, we got a guy that got a problem, and so we want you to assume from these other bad acts that he did something wrong here. That's not fair.
Well, if competency is not a jury issue, why are defendant doctors testifying to all of their credentials and their board certification, et cetera? Shouldn't that be inadmissible under your scenario?
No, sir. It's not inadmissible because you still have to establish what the standard is. That is, okay, we are a group of neurosurgeons. We all belong to INS or INNS or whatever it is. And under these circumstances, the conservative ones of us and the more aggressive ones of us, the standard is in this bracket. And they would establish for their own credibility that I went to school. I did a residency. If I did a fellowship, I did a fellowship. If I'm teaching at a college, I've trained X number of neurosurgeons, those kinds of things. That would go to their credibility, judge, and not specifically the issue of their personal competency. And that would go to their credibility on, here's what reasonable people do, folks. And this is what this guy got wrong. That's the appropriate way to try a malpractice case, not that we've got a stipulation out here.
Well, but doesn't
that
go,
a bad guy.
Doesn't that circle back to Justice Meyer Henry's question, though? If it goes to the issue of credibility, and he stipulated that he lacks all of those things that we just talked about, doesn't that go to his credibility as to all of the opinions that he testified to?
He never testified to standard of care, Judge.
But he testified to a lot of other expert opinions.
He testified with the records up alongside of him where, for the most part, he was relating exactly what was in the detailed records of his case. I mean, where he came the closest to opinions was in cross-examination by counsel. And, of course, that there's nothing that I can do to avoid those pieces.
To be fair, when you look at all the testimony, he really did testify as an expert here, didn't he?
Pardon me?
Didn't he, I mean, in fairness, didn't he really testify as an expert in this case?
You know, you struggle.
I mean, let me give you just a couple examples. He said he felt that a conservative surgical approach would be the most appropriate for Ms. Musall given her symptoms. Given her symptoms, her findings, and her radiographic studies, he also said, because she had low back pain, I saw no reason to get flexion extension films. Those are medical opinions.
And those are questions that were asked, I believe, by Mr. Lowe's. I mean, Mr. Lowe's was trying to bait Dr. Schwartz, if you will, into these kinds of things.
But
so we can have this argument.
Those are answers.
I think they are answers. There's no question about it. And certainly with somebody on the witness stand, nobody ever said that Dr. Schwartz couldn't answer. He certainly wasn't asked those questions by me. But I think the appropriate inquiry, I think that if we get too tied up on if it's an expert, we go too far. I mean, this court, and I'm going to go through my notes quick. I'm not going to. It's either Beath or Papke. You talked about the witness who ends up giving opinions, who got their knowledge from the treatment or diagnosis of the patient rather than being hired just to review records. And it was one of the first times that I had seen something where I think the percipient fact witness issue came up. And I think that's where Dr. Schwartz fit here. And he fit here as, I'm here to tell you what I did. He didn't go so far as to say what I did is right. But Dr. Bailey came and testified that this is the workup that's appropriate and the things that were done were right. Is it fair for a doctor like Dr. Schwartz to be judged on the acts that he did and whether they met the standard of care rather than a document that's just a testimony of things other things that he's been accused of? And, of course, that's what the struggles of the trial court constantly. But in this case, 404B and 403...
2 minutes.
I see that. Thank you. Would indicate that this information should not have come in as it did not, and that the judgment for Dr. Schwartz should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Lowe, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll pick up where Mr. Braun left off, I think it's becoming sort of a central issue, at least in terms of some of the questioning. Was Dr. Schwartz testifying as an expert? And I think it's clear from the voluminous testimony, and I just merely asked the court to review the briefs. The questioning that I did of Dr. Schwartz is less than 5% of these 100 pages of transcript of highly technical information. And once we get to the place where, despite some fiction that he didn't use the word standard of care, that he was in fact giving expert testimony, then this court's case law, including Martin Moss, including many others, says impeachment regarding your background, your skill, your license is relevant. Martin Moss made very, very clear that on the issue of the testifying doctor's credibility and his opinions as an expert, it was perfectly fair game to tell the jury he doesn't have a medical license. And I don't think it's a great leap to apply that fact in this case. And the reference by Mr. Braun to the Martin Moss case about what was excluded in that case misses the mark, totally misses the mark. Because if you read the Martin Moss case, the concern was we need to protect that information that the statute deems confidential. And if we review the Medical Practice Act, the state board's peer review privilege, it talks about that type of information that can never be disclosed, can never be subject to discovery, can never be admissible. Well, Dr. Schwartz's order of probation on its face says it's a public record. So we have to ask, would a statute that says something that could never be disclosed, I mean, how could that possibly apply to an order of probation that's public on its face? Mr. Braun refers repeatedly to the Boomsma case. And I think, again, we've got distinctions that greatly make that of limited value. Boomsma was an expert witness, and I think the court's language was there was mere allegations of misconduct. And the court, under those circumstances, properly did the balancing test and said, we've got mere allegations of conduct, which would otherwise be very prejudicial information, and kept it out. Compare mere allegations with admissions that are set forth in the order of probation, and I think you can tell that the Boomsma case would be of pretty limited value to this court in terms of analyzing the expert witness issue. Same with the Veerstand case. I mean, the idea that this court said it's not negligence per se for an intern to practice medicine is entirely different than the duty that Dr. Schwartz had to possess the knowledge and skill of a reasonably trained neurosurgeon.
How much does informed consent, how much did that play into this case?
The court instructed on it, Your Honor. The court instructed on it because the issue, the medical issue was, Ms. Musso meets Dr. Schwartz July 5th or 6th of 2001. The very next day, she's on the surgical table having a multiple level laminectomy and foraminotomy exam, or surgery. Highly invasive, highly technical surgery. Less than half a year later, she's back under the knife undergoing a procedure called a posterior lumbar interbody fusion, a PLIF. And the question was, why wasn't the definitive surgery done the first time? And was it properly explained that that was an option that she made in a very, very short amount of time? And a woman who was not of particularly good general health, that she had to undergo two complicated spine surgeries in a year. We made that an issue in the case. Now, can a patient provide informed consent to a doctor who lacks the requisite skill and knowledge? I think, and I hope, and we've talked about, you know, the burden that these cases have placed on the parties and the lawyers and the judges. We want to try this case again. We want to try this case again. So I don't want to leave the court with the impression that the system is struggling or that there's some effort to minimize this. I think informed consent will be an issue again. It's not before the court now. Ms. Ron didn't object to the instruction that sets forth the two duties. I think that's very telling. And now he wants this court to ignore the very plain language of that instruction, not objected to, that Dr. Schwartz has two duties. But again, I don't think we need to have necessarily proof of some breach of this first duty to have this order of probation be admissible. Because certainly the expert testimony, impeachment on expert testimony, would get us there as well. Dr. Schwartz, in conclusion, wants to have it both ways. He wants to be able to absolve his issues with the state medical board, put his license on probation, admit that it was negligence, relieve himself from the risk of going forward with a hearing, and yet testify to juries as if he was perfectly competent to speak.
We don't know that he admitted to negligence, do we? On this record,
well,
the board.
If the stipulation, semantics, is the stipulation an admission? Well, it's a stipulation that he agreed to. The reason, the reported reasons for the order of probation was negligence. In other words, the regulatory bodies that keep track of physician licenses, to those entities, the reason for Dr. Schwartz's probation was negligence. We stipulated to it.
Malpractice, I think it was.
Malpractice. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's correct. So we very much want to try this case again. We think our client was deprived of a fair trial the first time, and we ask for the reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe.